Okay, let's get started. Hello, folks. Edition 2 of the Barrels Washburn podcast. Another exciting week of Celtics basketball and NBA basketball, because it's a lot of exciting games, a lot of amazing performances. And the Celtics, well, up and down a little bit, but a couple of, you know, good wins, but a couple of interesting and losses, games that they could have won, but didn't perform as well as they could have. And, you know, a team that just seems to be just so up and down this year. And of course, we'll bring in the great Dana Barros, three-point specialist, former all-star, all-time great BC player. Dana, how are you? And first, and we definitely want to get, we want to do this every week. We want to get one of your favorite memories. So I'm going to ask you one of your favorite all-time memories, or, and we're going to talk about this time the Big East. So Dana, how you doing? Great to have you again.
Definitely. Always a pleasure to be here, bro. And okay, that's a great memory in the Big East. I would say, other than playing so many great players, the only time we ever beat Georgetown was a buzzer beater at the Garden that I hit when they were like two or three in the country. So that's one of my greatest moments, because for the one and only time the Garden was packed for us, I hit a game. That was awesome to be able to do that. And at that time, they had Mutombo and Mourning at the same time and on the same team. So it was crazy.
I mean, if the younger fans don't understand how amazing the Big East was, I mean, in the 80s and the 90s, I mean, you're talking about Georgetown. I mean, we're not even and BC was on that second tier. But then, it was Michael Adams, and it was you. Like, BC had ballers, too, but you had Georgetown, Villanova, Syracuse, Pitt, BC. I mean, Seton Hall, St. John's. I mean, every game, a battle and a rivalry. I mean, there was no two teams in the Big East that liked each other. I mean, it was like every game was a war. And people ask me, covering the Celtics, I knew Mike Gorman because I grew up on the West Coast. In the West Coast, we had Big Monday, and which was the ESPN game. They would show a Big East game. Then I think they would show like a Big Ten game. And they called it Big Monday. But when we got home from school at like 4:30, we were in the West Pacific time. The Big East game was already on. So we would get home from school and you would see it was BC and Pitt or Villanova, Georgetown, like that's, and there was Gorman doing those games. So as much as Gorman is a Celtic guy for the people here, for me, he's the dude who was like the Big Monday guy. And every Monday, it seemed like an intense rivalry between whatever two teams, they were going at it.
Definitely. I mean, I remember Big Monday was, I think that literally made ESPN. That was the number one show on ESPN the first 5 years of its existence. Then it expanded out to Tuesdays and Wednesdays and this, but the Big East was Monday. Big Monday, I remember watching Pearl Washington, you know, playing against at the Garden against St. John's, or it was like you said, every week it was just, you know, and I remember back to back years, we had three teams in the Final Four. And then the next year after that, we had two teams in the Final Four, and those two teams played for the championship. So it was domination in the NCAA, and it was almost scary because they kind of targeted Georgetown because they had that hood military mentality, you know, and they started targeting Georgetown and John Thompson in terms of it's too much ghetto, it's too much hood with the high sneakers, and they became kind of their motto, okay, us against the world. We the bad guys, let's go. And now they were like the Raiders of the NCAA, man. But it was all love. I loved it. It prepared me so well for the league, man.
I mean, I would assume, you played against countless NBA players who played in the Big East. I mean, that was just a breeding ground. And I think the Big East also made East Coast basketball just back then. It was, you know, with Jordan, it was Carolina and all that, Kentucky. But then suddenly in the late 80s, all the attention moved to like the Northeast. Like that's where every baller around the country watching ESPN, watching Big Monday wanted to play. I'm sure BC recruited probably a handful of guys from other places because people saw BC play with you and other guys on Big Monday. What was like the intent, like when you're that young and you're playing, do you even realize kind of like the intensity level? How, like you said, how did that toughen you up and prepare you for the league when you're 18, 19 years old and you're playing just such a high level game, packed crowds, fans yelling stuff at you? What was that like?
It was an amazing experience because I remember my senior year during the tournament, you know, it was some pretty big crowds and I never watched the crowd until I saw some pictures. And then being able to play at the Garden as a freshman, I remember I had to start. Myself and Jamie Benton were going out. He got hurt and I ended up starting right at the beginning, right out the gate. So there wasn't time to even think about it. And I remember the first five or six games, we went to a Christmas tournament and we played against Muggsy Bogues in Wake Forest, and we played against Chuck Person in Auburn. So right out the gate, my freshman year, I'm playing against, like you said, NBA players. They weren't even in the Big East at the time. So once the Big East season started, man, it was just like hands on deck every day, every game. It was like being in the league. I was, you know, I say it's like the G League. So, man, it just prepared me. Like I said, every game, I was Charles Smith, Pearl Washington. Mark Jackson was at St. John's. There was every team had a guard. Billy Donovan was at Providence. You go down the line. So yeah, and everything was in that East. That's why you said Big East, the Eastern basketball. And I remember my parents could drive to every single Big East game, Washington, you know, Villanova. They could just get in the car and drive to the game. So yeah, that's the one thing that the Big East can never recreate, man, was that Northeast. We the best mentality.
What do you think BC has been currently trying to get back? I mean, they had a couple of good runs. I mean, they had NBA players with Jared Dudley and Craig Smith and Reggie Jackson over the last like decade, 10 or 15 years, because Dudley's now retired. When you observe BC back, what could it ever get back to where it was making tournaments like when you were there, when it was a national factor? Because it seems like the Boston area, and we could talk about this because you were from here, like whenever there's a kid that is 13 or 14 years old that's from Boston that can play, some prep school is grabbing them and taking them out of Boston, the area in New Hampshire or Vermont or Connecticut, and he's playing there. And like Boston doesn't produce the ballers because by the time – they get to a certain age, like these prep schools around here take them. Like, and could BC get return to where it's a national factor?
Well, I mean, I think it's a big job. And I spoke with, and I actually, Earl Grant, the new coach, asked me to come on. And I told him I would come on from the standpoint and do some consulting from the alumni standpoint, because me being an alumni, I just really didn't have a connection with the school. And that's the one thing that I think is most important for you know, the university going forward, is what I told Earl is we got to get the guys who were here, who played here, whether they made it to the league or not, those guys got to get back involved. And that's, to me, my most important goal, because you can't go forward until you recreate. Well, we can't until you bring those guys back in the fold. And it can help us so much, you know, get better from that standpoint. So he understands it's a big job, bro. It's a big job. And but it starts with recruiting in our own area. And from the standpoint of what you said of kids coming through, I just remember speaking to Earl when he was hired. He came to my gym twice, just out the blue. We had long conversations, real conversations about everything. And he was telling me that he was reaching out to players and they were seniors. And he said they were from Boston. And he said that they hadn't ever heard from BC. And these kids have been stars for 2 and 3 years, and the previous coaches hadn't even reached out to these players. So he's just, from a standpoint, he's starting from behind. You know, he didn't even have enough players to field a full team. He had, they didn't recruit, you know, so
yeah,
he's been big rubble, man. You know, and I give him a lot of credit. I've been to practices, I've been to games. He's putting the work in, but recruiting is the most important thing. And I think us players spread out across the country can help him get those players from their states, whether it be Boston or Troy Bell from the Minnesota, St. Louis area, or, you know, Scooney Penn or whatever. We can all pitch in and say, hey, we're legit now. We got new facilities coming. So that's what's needed, you know, from the standpoint of just the foundation, the facilities was the most important thing, and that's getting taken care of now. So, you know, there's a little base going, but we'll see how it goes, and hopefully Earl can turn it around, you know. I'm cheering for him, bro.
The one thing, Dana, that I noticed is that BC never plays the Garden anymore. Like, how much of a recruiting tool would it be for BC to play 3 or 4 games or play a, you know, even a tournament or play some type of situation where they bring in a team from UCLA or Texas or somebody and play it at the Garden? I mean, that to me, because Conte Forum is a nice little college arena, but you're not going to get some of these dudes coming in and tour and when they don't fill the place, except when Duke and Carolina come. It seems like you could use the TD Garden. I don't know about the expenses or whatever, as a kind of a recruiting base to say, hey, you can, because I remember Georgetown played where the Bullets played, Villanova played where the Sixers played, you played where the Celtics played. You guys were playing, the teams in NBA cities were playing in NBA arenas. So you had that recruiting pitch. Like you was playing where Barkley played. You was playing where Bird and McHale played. You was playing where Elvin Hayes and Wes Unseld played. Like that, it's got to be a recruiting chip.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think not only basketball, but a lot of sports were overlooked in the previous administrations. And that's what I will give a lot of credit to the new AD, Pat Kraft, who raised millions and millions of dollars. And we're finally getting like a new practice facility where we are actually in their own space where they can actually recruit and have game rooms and places for the players to come and hang out and work out whenever they want. They're not sharing the actual gym with volleyball or baseball or other teams. So again, like I said, the foundation, that's one of the biggest things. So I give them a lot of credit for that. But again, it's just going to come down to who's on the court, you know. And if we can't dominate the New England area, I think it's going to be difficult, because we've had, like you said, a lot of Michael Carter Williams, Noel, and then not even just the most recent, Shabazz Napier, and bunch of different guys who didn't even consider Boston College. And that's a culture that has to change. So, you know, hopefully I can help them bring about a new culture, because that's unforgivable, man. When you have 5 or 6 NBA players that didn't even consider coming to that the home base, you know?
I remember during his pre-draft interview, Georges Niang, who is now with the Sixers, who played 3, 4, 5 years with Utah. He came out the league from Iowa State about 7 years ago, and he's from Massachusetts, and said his heart was set on playing at BC, and they never recruited him. He ended up going to Iowa State. Like, that's inexcusable when you have an NBA caliber player. And hey, he's not a great NBA player, but he's in the league. He's productive. He's doing his thing. He's been in the league 5, 6 years now, saying he wants to go to BC, and said BC never really looked at him, and he ended up going to Iowa State, being all, you know, Big 12 and all that, getting drafted and now playing with the Sixers. So it seems like there's a lot of work to be done, and there's a lot of talent, you know, in the Boston area, you know, in terms of, but like I said, you don't see the emphasis. You see the emphasis on hockey, but you don't see the high school hoops emphasis. And unfortunately, there was a young man, Terrence Clark, who was from here, who recently, unfortunately, died tragically, who was kind of Boston's latest hope. Hopefully, they can bring some kids and have more kids come up, and then they could consider playing at the home school, Boston College, because I do think, and I want to get your thoughts on this, going to the ACC, it brought more money, But man, it just robbed BC of their rivals. It robbed it of its kind of like the Virginia Techs and the Clemsons. Like fans just ain't going to respond to that basketball wise. Like it seemed like it was a good move for football, really, but taking it out of the Big East, no UConn, you know, Syracuse and Pitt, okay, but like no Villanova, no Georgetown, like that really robbed the basketball program of its identity.
Definitely. They lost a lot of history. I mean, people don't even remember the history. The ACC really doesn't promote the history of Boston College in terms of its Big East past. And it's almost, it reminds me of the Seattle Supersonics, where it's almost like they never existed. You know what I mean? A lot of those rivalries where you would play at the Providence Civic Center, you would play a Connecticut or a Providence at the Boston Garden instead of at the Conti Forum. You know, a lot of those New England things, you would have packed houses. The arenas would be full from a Boston College standpoint, which hasn't been for a while. And that's another thing that, you know, it was an issue of them not playing at the Garden. It's been difficult for them to fill up the Conti Forum. So I think in playing Northeastern and BU has kind of been taken off the map because of the losses to Harvard in the past 4 or 5, you know. So
yeah,
there's so many issues, man. And I just think from the standpoint of dominating the New England, especially the Boston area, is going to be essential for Earl. And as much as I can, you know, a lot of those players when they're young come through my facility, you know, people tell me, "Yo, that's the number one player, that's the number da, 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 da." We have the Gatorade 100 Nationals, the Adidas 100 Nationals there, so I get to see all these guys. And then, you know, my guys will videotape certain games and say, "This guy's going to Memphis, just look at him take off on it," you know. And it's just, I get to see these guys kind of freshman, sophomore, junior, senior. And, you know, hopefully we can create a culture where they, you know me not only for my NBA career, but I also went to Boston College and still represent, you know, what that stands for in the new culture, you know.
Dan, I want to get your thoughts on the younger athletes. Like, you were a high school recruit. You were looking at schools. I'm sure you had a long list of schools before you committed to Boston College. And you had your list of priorities. What's important to me? Is it playing close to my family? Do I want my mom and my dad and my brothers or sisters or whatever to go see every game? Or do I want to get the heck out of Boston and go somewhere, see somewhere else? Do I want to get out of the hood? Do I want to stay home? Do I want to play for a renowned coach? Do I want to start as a freshman? All those things were important. What's the difference now with young guys and gals when they come out and they're in high school? Because it seems like their priority thing is different. I mean, what is it that you notice about young athletes that's important to them about where they might choose to go to school?
Yes, it's a different era, because I know just from like an AAU standpoint, kids jump from team to team year to year. It's like, oh, they're giving out sneakers and uniforms. They'll leave and go play for this other team or that team because they're going to Philadelphia or they're going to Nevada, and it's all free. And so there's a lot of that from these kids from the time they're in seventh, eighth, ninth grade. Come play for me. You don't have to pay. We'll give you this. We'll give you that. So there's a lot of that going on very young for these kids. So then you get to college and then you go to these different universities and you go to Clemson and Duke and you see these unbelievable facilities, right? And then you come up to Boston College or you go to a different facility and it's not that. And to me, that matters so much. What sneaker contracts you have, what gear do you have? Like, these things are like people, I remember, because even back in the day, I remember people picking Syracuse because they wore the Air Force Knights. You know what I'm saying? Like, they got the Air Force Knights and the Barclays and all this. Yeah. And I'm like, crazy. So there's so much of non-basketball factors that go into these kids nowadays. You know what I mean? Where's the campus at? What's the girls like? And then you can find out so many things instantly on Instagram now about a school. I don't even want to take a visit. I went on there and looked at this and I saw this and da, 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 you know what I mean? So it's so much access for them to be able to be choosy, because coaches can reach out to anyone at any time. When I was playing, there was no cell phones, no internet. So you can be seen at any point, anytime, post your own videos on YouTube, create your own your own culture around yourself. And so I think it's more difficult now because of transfer portals with these colleges. So the kid now, like, yo, you didn't, I can't, you told me I was going to come here and play 29 and get to play. I'm out. I'm in the transfer portal. So that's another thing that's been great for the kids to have another option, but it's hurting the universities and the coaches who aren't keeping up their, you know, ends of the bargain on making false promises as well.
I mean, that's a thing, Dan. I just remember that every colleges, the players had an identity, like the player state, Grant Hill with Duke, Christian Laettner, like every kid had an identity because he was at college at least 2 years. The 2 years was the minimum, right? Because there wasn't no many one and dones back in those days. I think it might've been like a Tim Thomas from Villanova was one of the first, like going, because it was one of those, well, if you went to college, you were just going to stay at least 2 years. Mm. And you developed an identity. You know, you look at all around the, like, Ewing. I mean, obviously, Ewing would have, if it were now, would have came straight out of high school or would have been at G-Town 1 year, and then he would have left, the same with maybe Mutombo, maybe Alonzo Mourning, because it was just such a different element. But you established an identity, and that just helps you for your life. Like, people still affiliate you with BC because they remember you playing 100 games with BC. You know, right. The same with Michael Adams. Say, like, they remember you. We look at the NBA now and you just like, I remember him playing in Kentucky. Like, when was he at Kentucky? Like, cause these guys are playing like 26 games and then that's it. And they've barely made a college memory. It's just, it's so interesting now. Like you said, and now the transfer portal, these kids will play at three different schools and have no issue with it. Like, they'll, you know, they don't mind. I'm gonna transfer within the conference. Remember, that was a gift. Oh no, you don't transfer within the conference. You don't do none of that. That's you're a traitor if you do that. Now these kids, I seen a football player today, played at Stanford, committed to USC. Like, yo, you don't do that. But it's just so different. It just seems like college recruiting has got to be these days the most difficult job to, you know, you got to get these kids cell numbers. You got to follow them on IG. You got to see what they're talking about. You got to, like, it just seems like it's almost impossible. Get to know their family. All of these things that it just seems like, and even in your job, where these young people come to you and they call you, you know, what's up, OG? And I guess that means respect, or they call you boss or things and not Mr. Barrows. That's not very, I'm sure you don't hear that a lot. Like, we were taught, call him Mr. This. They just call you D. What's up, D? Like, what? Huh? Like what? Dana, like who, like you, 13, 14 years old. Like, what's that like to deal with just the different, but you know, they are who they are. They're raised who they are. They don't know any better, but it just seems like it's just so different.
Yeah, I've been doing this since 88 when I had my first basketball camp. So I've seen so many kids who, when they were 11, 12 years old, were these unbelievable phenoms. And people are like, we're going to the league. You know, and by the time they're 14, 2-3 years later, they're not even playing anymore. They're overweight or they haven't grown anymore. They don't understand what it takes. So it's a marathon, man. And these kids are getting into situations where it's so easy and quick for them. They can go play AAU, do whatever they want. They go to college for 1 year, then they get to the NBA, or they get to a situation where it's not easy. And then the adversity hits you. And I see so many people who don't understand how to deal with adversity, these young kids and these young players, man. It's just, you don't like what it is, you want to move. You want to keep it moving and do something else or go somewhere else. And the discipline that it takes to be a 10-year NBA player, I don't think is instilled in these kids anymore. It's just, if a coach isn't playing you, if a organization doesn't, you can just do whatever you want to do. Where now, as you get to the league, it's like you got a contract, you get stuck in these situations. And it's, to me, there's not enough diversity in their games to be able to deal with the adversity. To me, it's just And I tell parents all the time, how come, you know, how come these kids can't shoot free throws? And da-da-da. I say, well, damn, like, you need to look at it from their perspective. I get it, but I don't get it. Because if I'm 16 years old and I can take off and dunk from the free throw line, you got to be a weirdo to practice free throws. You know what I'm saying?
Like, yeah, yeah.
We don't have the weirdos like we used to, because they're so athletic now. It's easy for them, you know?
Is the fundamentals the same? Like, I think about 30, 35 years ago, the fundamentals were stressed, but also the athletes weren't the same. It just seems now that it's so different. Like, I went to a high school game a couple of days ago, and, you know, the skills are there. Like, you could tell, Dana, they watch the NBA. Everybody want to be Steph. Everybody knows the Euro step. They know these things. They pick this stuff up, but it just seems like the fundamentals aren't quite there. The free throw shooting, everybody wants to take threes. It just seems like the NBA game, the positives, but also the negatives have spilled over to youth basketball, to where these kids now are just like, they're freestyling a lot.
And a lot of it is just, they practice moves. So they'll do the James Harden step back move. They'll do that really well. Obviously, they don't make the shot, you know, but they just think everybody's, oh! Yeah. And the shot, everybody's talking about the move. So they're so much more athletic. They have the skill to be so much more, you know, better all across the board, but they don't do, if I asked you to take the ball off the rebound and dribble the full length of the court with your left hand and make a left-hand layup on the run, you can't do that. But you can do a James Harden between the legs behind the back, step back. I'm like, how can you do that and not do that? You know what I'm saying? So the athleticism is way, you know, we have five Michael Jordans on every team now. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Only one air, the way he could hang, but they're all as athletic, you know. But they just don't have – you could take them out of their game by doing one thing. They either shoot really well, and you just get up on them and they don't handle well. They either handle really well and they're a slasher and they can't shoot. And then, you know what I mean? It's not, what are we going to do with this guy? You know, there's very few of them coming up.
And is it improving at all? Like, I think the Curry factor, we talked about this last week, the Curry factor really changed basketball, because everybody wants to shoot threes. And every little guy thinks he can ball, you know, because it used to be, if you were a little guy like yourself, a smaller player, you had to be fast. Like, you had to take somebody off the dribble, get to the rim. Like, you can't, nobody could stay in front of an you know, Dana Barros in his prime. And you could also shoot. Or you talked about Muggsy Bogues or some of these dudes, AI, like, you couldn't stay in front of them. Like, is it getting better now with, maybe some of the things, or is it still kind of, like you said, raw? Some of these kids are, like you said, I remember always being taught by my father, my late father, use your left hand. Don't quit dribbling with your right. Use your left. Work on your left. Now it seems like some of these kids do, but some of them also, like you said, can't dribble the ball down the floor because they don't think they have to. They could be Ben Simmons. Like, Ben Simmons doesn't know how to shoot. They're like, well, I make the league, now I don't want to shoot. Look at him.
Yeah, I mean, it's all, like, to me, the game should be instinctual, but you see a lot, almost 95% of the guys dribbling down court, when they get to half court, I'll say out loud, or I say to myself, here comes the Euro step, you're going to Euro step. Every person, no matter what the defense does, you're going to see him do. And it's just like they're doing moves. They're not – oh, if he jumps, okay, I'm inside out instinctually. It's not Isaiah Thomas from 86 where he can do any move, but it only comes out off of a counter reaction to what you're doing. You know what I mean? These guys get the ball, back out five steps, and as they're backing out, they're like, okay, I'm going to do this move. You know what I mean? It's so crazy. Just watch it. But the athleticism, it intrigues you, because Russell Westbrook, for example, he'll – make an unbelievable dunk on Rudy Gobert, and wow, the whole arena will be electric, and but then he'll make four turnovers.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Most basic bounce pass, miss a left hand layup. So you get the whole spectrum with this different generation, man. You get the oohs and the ahs of the super athleticism. And then you sit there and you're like, you taking a $40 million a year guy out the game because he can't shoot free throws.
Yeah.
Like, this doesn't even match up, right?
Yeah.
That's kind of what it is. It's so ironic about you're watching the most amazing athletes in the world doing the most amazing things, but yet cannot do the most simplest things that a fifth grader can do in any YMCA in America. It's crazy.
Yeah, speaking of Westbrook, he moved to the NBA, like, gets the Indiana Pacers. Like you said, he gets benched the last 4 minutes because he can't guard Caris LeVert. Like, that's – and when you're I know you played the league. NBA is a pride league. It's a reputation league. How tough is that when you put together, like, the Lakers? Everyone – ripped the Lakers in the offseason because they were signing everybody who was over 35. I mean, Melo, Dwight, they brought back Trevor Ariza, and then they bring in Russ. Like, they're getting the 30 and over team with LeBron at the lead. They were hoping AD would remain healthy, and they were supposed to make a run here. But how tough is it when you have all those egos and then you bring in a guy like Russ, who is going to play his way? He's 32, he's 33 years old. Russ ain't changing. Mm-hmm. And I think sometimes, as we discuss, not being able to change at that age gets you out the league. Because if you, like, I look at Allen Iverson, Allen didn't want to do the little things. He just wanted to be AI. He got older. He lost a step. And teams were like, you don't have that first step anymore. What good are you? Like, even if we look at Carmelo had to learn. Remember when he laughed in Oklahoma City about coming off the bench? What? Like, now, dude, you're a gunner. Like, that's who you are, Melo. You're not that 29-7-6 guy you were with the Knicks. Like, how tough is that when you are that? Because that ego at that stage to play and try to move, change your game and transform your game to win when you might be losing some stuff.
Well, it's the most difficult for an athlete because at LeBron and Westbrook and Carmelo's age, you're thinking, okay, I've been able to do this and carry these teams for these years, and you can't carry them at your age anymore. You can play in spurts. You brought in Russell Westbrook and you got rid of your dogs on the perimeter who would do the dirty work. Schroeder didn't come back. You made an offer to him, obviously. He didn't come back. Pope is gone. Kuzma's gone. These were the young dogs who would get out on the wing so LeBron and Carmelo didn't have to guard these young athletic wing slash players, and they could sit back and play the weakest guy on the floor, the weakest link, and help here and there. That's not the case anymore. You went older to think you're getting better. You got less effective on the perimeter, less shooting on the perimeter. And from a defensive standpoint, it's just atrocious. So bringing Russell Westbrook in, to me, is exacerbated by his mentality. When you're going through processes that he's going through of struggling, the most important thing is to slow down. He don't have that in his – he doesn't have that in his bag. He has one motor speed. He's in six speed. He's going full tilt. And when you're mentally struggling, you need to slow down. And he's even speeding up to me. So this is a mental block with him. And sometimes it lasts a season. Sometimes they snap out of it, maybe all-star break. But this is a disaster. Him not playing the last two fourth quarters – is only getting worse, and he didn't talk to the media last night. And if he did, we would be talking about a bunch of whole of this right now.
Yeah,
because he's hot right now, but it's not working. And everyone knew it. Even me, I'm looking at it like Russell West, you know, DeMar DeRozan or get Dame Glitz, like get somebody different, you know, like, but man, it's bad. And I can't even imagine that locker room. Frank Vogel is going to be probably the first one to be blamed for this. But yeah, he probably had who would bring in Westbrook there. So yeah, it's a mess, man. And you're too old to pick up 94 feet and to try to change how you play, man. You're almost better off going to a zone and trying to save as much energy as you can from this standpoint and play a more solid game on a defensive end.
Boy, I tell you, like, with a guy like Russell Westbrook, I don't remember any, and maybe his teammate, Dwight Howard, I don't remember a more criticized guy who's going to the Hall of Fame. Like, Russ is going to the Hall of Fame. He's put up these numbers. People love his energy, but man, does he get like so heavily scrutinized? And he asks for it with his style, his recklessness, the turnovers. Especially as he's gotten older, he hasn't like refined his game. His game is still, straight Hennessy,
Russ gonna play how Russ play.
it's still straight hen, no chaser, no coke to level it off. It is like, and you see athletes, and I applaud LeBron for this. LeBron knows father time is kicking in. So what do? I become a better shooter, perimeter shooter. So he's become a better three-point shooter. I get that step back down. I don't have to dunk on everybody and everything. I'll just lay it in. I'll master layups. Because it's too much energy to be just trying to go, two hands on dudes like I did when I was 23. And I just think that's what keeps you in the league. And it's like Russell, it seems like he's taking kind of like a express lane out of the league, but he's made so much money. They paid him that $40 million. I think it was Oklahoma City a couple of years ago. I applaud and appreciate his game. I remember when he got drafted by the Sonics, then went to the Thunder, then became the Thunder, and just that energy and that chip on his shoulder. But it's, as we both know, like when you get to that early 30s, you definitely have to refine your game to stay around.
Yeah, and he just from the standpoint of his decision-making and the timing of the decision-making, I would be even okay, and I'm sure the fans wouldn't even remember the 6 turnovers in the first 3 quarters if you just didn't do it in the last 8 minutes of the game. Mm-hmm. So he just would get off the ball in the last 8 minutes, make 1 or 2 plays, and I think that we could all understand, okay, this is who he is, but he's not successful in his decision-making. We all understand who Allen Iverson was, who Sprewell were. You have to just let them go. You can't say, don't do this and don't do that. But they were successful when they were at their prime doing what they did. You know what I mean? This is just, he has that mentality, but the success rate and the decision-making is atrocious. You have Kevin Durant on the floor, and you're dribbling down in the NBA Finals and just give him the ball, bro. And it's just so, I think that's the thing, the timing of his decision-making. And it's just, at this point in his career, the stakes are high because it's not just about him. LeBron James has his legacy. Anthony Davis got a big monkey on his back about him not achieving what everyone thinks he should achieve. And he's affecting the other legacies from their standpoint. So that's why, to me, it's a big deal, because he has not only he can say, I don't care about winning championships all you want, but you're with that guy who needs as many as possible the next 3 years and be a hindrance to that.
And Russ doesn't have a title. That's the thing. Everybody, all of his peers, besides Carmelo, all the dudes around him, even Dwight got a title. LeBron got titles. KD got titles. All his contemporaries, all this guy, his rivals, all seem to have titles. And here's Russ, still on that, I'm the man kind of island, but it's like, that's not winning you no titles. And if he retires without a title, he lives to that Barkley thing, that Karl Malone, well, you were good, but you didn't win no title. Like, I'm sure. And as much as it wasn't Barkley's fault. He went to one championship, didn't win it, lost to Jordan. That still hovers over your head, like you didn't get that ultimate prize. I mean, that's got to be – that's lingering. That's hovering over Russell's head. That's why he wanted to go to L.A., to thinking he thought he was the final piece of that puzzle. That's the thing. That's the crazy part is he was like, oh, I'm going to do this. Like, this is – we win it.
And now he's realizing that he's the problem and he's trying to out of it. But that's, man, that's a mind, you know what? You know what I mean? Like, he's in the twilight zone. He's like, everybody's saying I'm the problem. I don't know how to fix it. So, but he's just speeding up, man. He's just speeding up. And I think Frank Vogel is in a real tough position because if he wants to win, he's going to have to do what he's been doing, not playing him in the last, couple of minutes of the game. And then LeBron is going to have to handle that in the locker room, otherwise – in the next week or so, another loss, two losses, Frank Vogel could be out of there, man. You know, it's getting ugly because I think the organization, Rob Pelinka, everyone from the organization is on the table now. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. About bringing Russ in and then hiring, keeping Frank, whatever. Now there, once you start putting the whole organization on the table, there's going to be a scapegoat, and it's not going to be LeBron. Or I don't think you can trade Westbrook,
No. Not with that contract. With the Celtics 500 record, they lost the other night to the Charlotte Hornets. Charlotte played well enough to win, but the Celtics, again, erratic from the three-point line, just could not hit long-range shots, had a lot of open looks, especially Jason Tatum is what I wanted to talk about. Tatum is – a guy coming off the Olympic experience, helping the U.S. to the gold medal. I was there. He was the second best player on that team behind Durant. And then I would put him and maybe Drew Holiday was also very good for Team USA. So Tatum's coming off the gold medal, wants to come into this season and have it a monster season, wants to be in the MVP talk. And he's struggling, like 31%. He's a career 39% three-point shooter, 31 this year. You're the expert at the three ball. And five of his seven looks against Charlotte were open or moderately open where there was a light contest, but he had a clear, clean look. What happens what do you do when you're struggling from three? Because obviously you took thousands of shots a day, and it's a shot that, I've seen Marcus Smart in practice over the years take hundreds of three pointers, twist. You get into a game, he's 30%, right? Like, what's the difference between one, hitting them in the game and hitting them in practice, and two, when you're in a slump, how do you get out of that? Jason, it's been a season long slump. He's had a 2-for-15 from three, a couple of 1-for-9s, just a 2-for-10, like, stuff that's uncharacteristic. How does he get out of this?
Well, getting to the free throw line is important. But to me, I just don't think there's enough shooters on the floor. You know what I mean? If you're going to take that many threes, I think there should be more shooters on the floor. And there's not a lot of space. Robert Williams is playing tremendously well on the defensive, and he's saving you in a lot of these games. So he has to be on the floor. So to me, I think Tatum is getting pushed out further and further. It's getting harder. He has to work harder and harder to get to that mid-range to get his shot off. And even then, there's collapsing around him, or it's a fadeaway because, again, it's so tight in there without the spacing on the floor. So he's moving further and further out, taking more and more threes. And, again, I said it in the last podcast, I look at the amount of threes they make. If they don't make 12, minimum of 12 threes, I feel like it's going to be a problem because they take so many. So when we start off the games and it's, 1-for-8 in the first quarter, I'm saying, okay, if this doesn't pick up in the second quarter, it's going to be an issue. Taking so many threes, I just think if Pritchard's not on the floor, Al doesn't make as many as he used to. Schroeder and Smart are okay shooters when their feet are set and they have time. They're not a catch right off the dribble and shoot the ball. And that's the shots they're taking. That's why the percentage is dropping down. So to me, man, you just, when you have two guys like that, you need, even if they're on the bench, you need to, all right, we gotta put in two or three knockdown shooters, man. You got, Miami has Duncan Robinson and Hero. And, you know what I mean? You just go down the line, and that's why Embiid is in Philly, to me, bringing Steph Curry in was huge. They had J.J. Redick before that. Even with Ben Simmons there, they still had those guys around him. So, man, it's just, to me, he's going to continue to struggle. And then maybe and I know when I played and getting double teamed constantly off pick and rolls, I would play the clock in the foul situation. So if I know the next foul is in the penalty and there's 3 minutes left in the quarter, I'm running into any and everyone. Maybe you get 6 out of 8, okay? But that's 6, that's 12 free throws, you know what I mean? 6 out of 8. And you have to score your points in different ways. I would say, okay, I wouldn't even try to score in the half court, but when the ball comes off the rim and it's the open floor, I'm running, I'm getting 3 charges because I'm getting to the rack to get these free throws because they're not letting me play. And to me, that's where the open floor and the clock in the free throw game, the bonus situation game, is where I would get 6 to 8 points a game just playing that, you know, foul situation game to me. And that's why the great scorers average 10 to 12 free throws a game, you know, the top scorers in the game, because they know how to play that situation. So I don't think it's going to get better with the way they play unless they shoot better. You know, the guys around him shoot better, in my opinion.
Yeah, I'm looking at the box score. 14 for 46 from the three-point line and a combined 2 for 18 from Brown and Tatum. The rest of the guys were fine, you know, but it just seems like they're so reliant, like you said, on the three-point shot that you've got to have more elite shooters to play that type of game where you're three-pointing teams out the gym. Like,
and you're not giving up 16 threes to the other team because exactly. Now the 14 is nothing, you know what I mean? So, yeah, that's an issue. I think to me, like I said all along, they got away with it being successful by having a really, really good defensive team. When you had Morris and Brown and Tatum were young, you had a really good defensive, out and dirty, dirty, grimy, you know, up in your face defensive team that could make up for that. You know, I don't think you have that right now. You just, you know, you're playing NBA league basketball, you know, run and chuck. That's across the board in the league.
And even the best shooters get in this, like Steph is now in a slump. I mean, he's shooting 39% from three, which is great for 90% of the league, but for him, that's low. When you are like, when you are a dude who shoots 1,000 jumpers a day, 900 of them go in, and you start slumping, what do you like? What? Wait a minute. I work too hard to be slumping. Like, what is going on? Why is this shot not going down? These are the ones I take in my sleep. How do you, how tough is that mentally when you are like wide open, clang? Like, when you've had your slumps, what's going through your mind?
The one thing that I was blessed with was, like, I wanted to know the best way to shoot, the best technical way to shoot. So when I would have a slump, before I actually learned the exact technical way out that you're supposed to shoot, I would look at the film and then I would say, damn, that seems slower than the other one, you know? And that's how I would say, but once I got to the point where when it's short, I'm holding the ball too long. But before that, I would watch film. I would watch my free throw. And I would shoot the ball and I would go like this because I didn't feel comfortable when I was shooting the ball. And I would say, this coming in and I'm going like this a little bit. And to me, I would always go back to the technical aspect of how I'm shooting the ball, releasing the ball. Am I jumping higher? Am I not jumping higher? I would always go back to that because I didn't want to play the mental game. You know what I mean? Like, I didn't want to say anything other than it has to be technical because it's supposed to be going in. So I have to be doing something wrong. And that's what I always fell back on. But, and I honestly, I didn't, when I get in those situations, I didn't go in the gym and take an extra 1,000. I would sit on the couch with the ball and I would just shoot the ball straight up in the air and watch the laces spin. Mm. And if they spun perfectly straight, then I knew that my release was straight. If I went like this, the ball would spin to the left or the right. Yeah. And that's what I would do. I would technically go back to the foundation of my shot. And then when I get to the gym, I felt like I would be, you know, better from that standpoint. So it's a mind thing, because it seems like since Steph broke the record, he's been going downhill ever since. Klay is back, and you think that would open the floor up more for him. But teams are also playing on the side of him. Like, I'm watching them. They're literally playing on the side of him, forcing him to drive and giving him the lane to drive. Mm-hmm. But he's realizing that. So he'll take the force, and then he'll take a step back and still try to get the three off, which is a difficult shot.
Yeah.
And that before, your legs are stronger. You're, every night you're ready to play. At 33, you just can't do that every night, bro.
Well, let me ask you about young kids. What would you suggest? Okay, so Curry changed the game. So he's making 30-footers. Then Dane's making 30-footers. Would you suggest that young players – start shooting those types of third? I remember, like, growing up, it's out of your range. What are you doing? Get right back around the hoop, around the circle, the free throw line, start from there, then go out. Now, the 30-footer is a common shot. Would you suggest that young players practice 30-footers?
No, absolutely not. Because what happens is you're not shooting the jump shot when you're that young. You're not strong enough to get the ball there, and you end up shooting a throw shot or a push shot, and you're just like, technically, it's terrible. So when you do move back in, now you've taken so many of these, the throw shots, you have your normal jump shot, you're shooting two different shots. So I never – my thing is this. If you can go to the high school or college three-point line and you can make 45% from there, then you can make 40% from 3 feet behind there, to me. You know what I mean? But if you're shooting 37 from the line, you're not going to go back 5 feet and shoot better. You know what I mean? To me, if you can shoot that 45 to 50% range from the normal three, then naturally when you move back 5 feet, you'll go down a little percentage, but I don't think there's a big drop off. So to me, the guys that are missing and the percentage drops way off, it's because they're not shooting jump shots. They're not strong enough to actually shoot those shots the way they're supposed to be shot. So I would never, ever consider that, you know? Yeah, sometimes we have half court throw shots because you do get those in the game and you play little games like that. But, you know, I just think it's foolishness, man. You know, I watch guys, we've criticized Tatum for doing this as well with 8, 7, 6 seconds on the clock. And watching James Harden and all Kevin Durant, and these guys are taking step back threes 2-3 feet behind the line for the final shots of the games, man.
Yeah.
Like, this is a normal shot in today's game. And I can promise you it's a 30% shot.
Yep. If you shoot like 35%, that's really good for that shot. I mean, I remember looking up Tatum on step back threes was like 27%. It looks beautiful when you make it, but you ain't making it that often, and that's the problem.
That's the end of a shot clock shot. That's what that's what you do when there's 4-3 seconds left and you got to get a shot off. You just create some space and you get a shot off. That's not, to me, when you have the ball with 15 seconds and you dribble and you're watching James Harden sit there and go like this and go like this, when you could have, you know, it's just foolishness to me. I just don't understand it, you know?
Well, Dana, I think that's it for this week. Covered a lot. The history of the Big East, what the younger players, what, you know, the new younger generation players, the situation in L.A. and now Boston. Always great talking to you. We're going to do this again next week. We'll have some more. The Celtics have some games. The Blazers come into town. Then they got the Wizards and then the Kings. So a couple of winnable games for the Celtics.
Must-wins.
Yeah. And we'll see if the Celtics can build on this and get some wins together and get away from 500, or are they going to continue to be the up and down team that we've seen all season, where they one minute you get that confidence in them, and then they have like an unexpected loss. So we'll see. But again, Dana, thank you. And we will talk again next week on the Washburn Barrels Washburn podcast.
Peace.